Hello, and welcome to another episode of Boundless Body Radio. I'm your host, Casey Ruff, and today we're releasing a special episode from a project I undertook in 2022 called the Boundless Body Radio Premium Podcast. My intention was to take all of the best clips about one particular topic and put them together as a masterclass to be released behind a paywall with a subscription-based service on Patreon. Well, we didn't have many subscribers, so I'm breaking up these episodes and releasing them here for free so that they can make an impact and hopefully help some people out there. Today's episode was taken from the second series, all about ketosis and the ketogenic diet. This is part one from the first episode. We always appreciate any feedback that you might have, so feel free to leave us a comment on YouTube or on our website at myboundlessbody.com, where you can always book a complimentary 30-minute session with us at any time. We've really just enjoyed connecting with so many people around the world. So please take us up on that offer, even if it's just to introduce yourself. And with that, enjoy part one of this two-part conversation all about the ketogenic diet. Hey, hey, this is Casey Ruff, and welcome to this, the fourth episode of the Boundless Body Radio Premium Podcast. Really hope you enjoyed the first three episodes. We did the first three episodes about the three macronutrients, so covering protein, carbohydrates, and fat. And this is going to be the first episode of another series exploring keto. We are going to be talking about what keto is, what is a ketogenic diet, what does it mean to be in ketosis. We're going to deep dive into all of that. The ketogenic diet, is, if you've been following along on our show, is something that's very special to me in my career as a personal trainer, nutrition coach. I found it at a time when I was recommending that people eat lots of whole grains, lots of fruits and vegetables, really try to avoid fat, especially saturated fat and red meat. And I just found that it wouldn't really work for so many people on so many different levels. And once we learned the power of the ketogenic diet and how to really apply it with our clients, we started seeing all kinds of results. It was like magic. People that were able to finally burn fat, they felt great. They weren't that hungry. They were able to skip meals and start intermittent fasting was a really special thing and really enriched my career. And I've really dedicated myself to studying keto and the ketogenic diet for really the last 5 years or so. So I'm really excited to do this. Like I said, we're going to put this in a series. So this will be the first episode, and I really wanted to deep dive into the science of keto. What is a ketogenic diet? What are the studies that support it? What are some really poorly done studies that you hear about all the time, which are absolutely bananas? We'll go into that. And we're going to start out this episode with some exclusive content. So we're going to be hearing from Bronson Dant, who is a personal trainer and nutrition coach. He is also the author of the Ultimate Ketogenic Fitness book. So this content will not be found anywhere else but here on the Boundless Body Radio Premium Podcast. We hosted Bronson back on episode 271 of Boundless Body Radio. I was able to meet him actually when he came out for Keto Salt Lake back in April of 2022. We instantly hit it off and was so happy to host him on the show and so happy to start out this episode with him, just kind of giving us some really high-level definitions, talking about different terms that people have and really addressing what are some of the things that are beneficial about ketones themselves. So that will be the start of this episode, which again, will focus more on the science. And then the next two episodes that I do, I'm planning around stories of people that have gone through ketogenic diet. So other people that have seen amazing benefits. This could be people in the health space and practitioners and also just regular people. And we're going to make that part of the series a little bit more practical, include a lot of tips and tricks for you so that you can do this and execute this really well. But right now, let's go to Bronson Dant for some exclusive content. Mr. Bronson Dant, author of the Ultimate Ketogenic Fitness book. How are you today, my friend?
Doing fantastic, man. Absolutely great. How about you?
Excellent. Doing great. You are the perfect person to bring on to get us started in this deep dive into ketosis. And so I'm going to ask right off the bat, What is ketosis?
It's probably not what a lot of people think it is. Ketosis is really just having a lot of ketones in your blood.
Perfect.
That's all it is. Yeah. That's it.
So when we're thinking of ketosis, people often get this mixed up with keto that they see on the magazine at the grocery store. Is that correct?
That is correct. Because the name of what we call the ketogenic diet, it has its origins in the medical community, brain injury, traumatic, trauma, multiple sclerosis, epilepsy, things like that. So it's a neurological protocol necessarily from a medical perspective. The concepts and the ideas of the ketogenic diet kind of spread across a broad range of application. So you can follow a ketogenic diet that's not the same structure as medical ketogenic diet, more, let's call it lifestyle or body composition ketogenic diet or general healing ketogenic diet. So there's different levels. And the idea behind the ketogenic diet from a general perspective is that your body is utilizing fat for fuel primarily, and you are not providing external sources of carbohydrates. That's the basis. Yeah. That's the basis. Now there's different levels, and that's where all the confusion comes in between what keto are you doing?
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So you already mentioned another term, ketogenesis. And if we just break that down, that's just the creation of ketones, which our body can do in the right circumstances. Another word that a lot of people, I think, hear and get confused by is ketoacidosis. That sounds a little bit more scary. Is following a ketogenic diet, is it dangerous?
If you have diabetes now and you have an issue where you have more ketones in your body can handle, then that can be a problem. But I have not personally, the hundreds of people I've worked with, I've never had anybody who's had that happen.
Yeah. I've never seen that happen to anybody outside of either a type 1 diabetic or type 2 diabetics that are very, very poorly controlled. Is that how you understand it? Okay.
Pretty much.
Cool. Great. So I'm glad we kind of got those terms down. What are some of the ways you talked about different levels, but what are some of the ways that somebody could be in ketosis and what benefits do you think they might notice?
So, I mean, again, the definition of ketosis just means you have high ketones. So there's a couple ways to get there. The first way is to take in exogenous ketones. If you eat ketones, you're going to have more ketones in your blood. So technically you are in ketosis. And there are some studies and there's some practical evidence, real life evidence, that a higher level of ketones in the blood are helpful for neurological function. So that's why if you look at medical ketogenesis, the focus is on being in ketosis, having a high number of ketones, and that being 0.5 to 3 millimoles on a reading on a ketone test, ketone stick. So that your brain is getting all of the fuel and energy that it needs from the cleanest, most efficient sources possible. And that is ketones. The difference being between taking in ketones so your body can burn them and teaching your body how to break down body fat and turn your body fat into ketones is that that level of ketosis can go up and down. You can be in and out of ketosis without it actually affecting whether or not you're ketogenic.
Got it.
Because ketosis is just a level of ketones. It doesn't have any bearing on where those ketones are coming from.
Got it.
And that's kind of the difference.
Got it. No, I really appreciate that. Tell us, you just mentioned sticking your finger. A lot of people hear if you do this diet, you have to test your blood, or some people say you need to test either your breath or you have to use pee strips to detect whether you are in this state and producing ketones. Do you personally recommend that people track whether they're in ketosis or not?
It depends on the goal. Again, if you're trying to do something specifically for neurological health and you're trying to improve some kind of neurological factor, and that could be all sorts of things. Primarily, again, neurological stuff, epilepsy, multiple sclerosis. I have clients that have fibromyalgia. There's things that are dealing with nerves and how the brain works and things like that, where having high ketones can definitely be beneficial. And depending on the severity, all sorts of things that are individual to the person, they may not need to be that way all the time. So testing may not always for the rest of their life be a requirement. But in those cases, I would highly recommend it because you want to stay there. For the general person who's just trying to fix their metabolism, lose some body fat, gain some muscle, improve their general quality of life, it's more important to be ketogenic than in ketosis.
Perfect.
So it's more important that your body is processing adipose tissue for fuel than it is for you to have high ketones, because high ketones just mean, literally, high ketones means excess fuel.
Got it.
So excess fuel, if it's fat, isn't any better than excess fuel if it's carbs, if you're trying to lose body fat and change your body composition.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so for that normal person who wants to try this diet, they might hear things that might deter them. Like, I've heard you get really nasty flu symptoms, or I've heard your breath can kind of stink, or I've heard that you have to eat, you know, cubes of butter. What are some of the weird things that you hear that you need to help kind of coach people through? And how do people get over that adaptation period that can be just a little bit uncomfortable at first?
Sure, sure. Number one, there's absolutely nothing wrong or uncomfortable about eating sticks of butter. I'll make that clear. It's absolutely fine. It's fantastic. You should learn to love it.
Dude, I went on a camping, as a side note, I went on a camping trip this weekend, and it was up in the mountains. You've been in, here in Salt Lake. And so I was up in the mountains. Yep. It was pretty high and pretty cold. I got to the point where I'd eaten all the food that I brought, and I literally had like a quarter of a cube of butter left for my coffee the next day. And I just threw it right down the hatch and just ate it as it was. It was delicious.
It's fantastic. So I do it probably more frequently than I should. but in general, the adaptation period is, we could get into a whole big discussion that is going to be way longer than 50 minutes about why you're making these changes and what you're trying to get out of it. And any discomfort that you go through in changing how your body functions to be more efficient, to have more energy, to be more capable, to do more things is going to be a change, which means it's going to be uncomfortable. But the question you have to ask is it more uncomfortable than the lifestyle you're currently living and the problems you're currently dealing with? So if you're dealing with health issues, if you're dealing with feeling limited in what your body can do, if you're dealing with feeling lethargic and lack of energy and just a general inability to function, then any change that's going to improve that long term is going to be worth it.
Yeah.
There's just ways to do it. So that's where following a program, getting a coach, joining a community, and learning some of the different ways to kind of maybe soften that process. So it's not as harsh or impactful or intense, and you don't need to do it all overnight, but learning how to kind of work yourself through the process of adaptation is the way to go. Normal day-to-day adaptation should take most people, let's say 7 to 14 days to kind of feel like you're okay. And you didn't completely get slammed with the keto flu. If you go hardcore overnight and just change everything overnight, then you're going to have 3 or 4 days where you are not going to feel well.
Yeah.
If you keep your electrolytes up, if you slowly transition out of the carbs, if you do some other things over a 3, 4, 7 day period, you'll be able to make that transition a little bit easier.
Yeah, no, that's great. I think the longer that you and I have been coaching people through this process, we've been able to make it far less severe and also much faster. And I kind of give the example of like, if you have a swimming pool, there's like a kind of a gradual end that you can go in more slowly and get used to the water. Or there's the platform on the other side where you can jump and do a cannonball into the pool. And either way, you're in the pool and you're wet. It's just, do you want to get it all over with really quickly? Or do you need it to be a little bit more slowly? And either one is totally fine.
Yeah. And some people are pull the bandaid off slowly. Other people are just rip it off. So it's kind of whatever works for you.
Yeah, that's right. I just want to know for you personally, Bronson Dan, if I were to take away the ketogenic diet from you right now and put you back on the standard American diet or the way that you were eating before you changed your life with this diet, how would that make you feel?
We'd be fighting, first of all. there'd be some confrontation. Secondly, how I would feel, I'd feel like crap because that's how I felt before I did this. I was 70 pounds overweight. I felt like crap. I had IBS and gut issues. I had no energy. I had a bad self-image, like everything about my life and how I envisioned my future was not positive. So where I'm at now, there's no way in hell I would want you to do that.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Yeah. I think, again, coaching so many people through this process, I know of very, very few people who would be willing to go back to their past way of life and lifestyle before doing the ketogenic diet than afterwards. I think everybody universally just feels so much better, so much more energy and mental clarity, and they feel better physically in all those ways that you mentioned. So I think that's a really great point and a great way to end. Bronson Dan, where do you want people to go to find you and connect with you in your work?
Yeah, you can find me pretty much anything Ultimate Ketogenic Fitness. If you type in Ultimate Ketogenic Fitness on Google, it'll come up with me from somewhere. So Instagram, YouTube, the book, my website, all that stuff, Ultimate Ketogenic Fitness, and I'll come up somewhere.
Perfect. Well, thank you so very much, Bronson Dan, for this exclusive content. So we really appreciate that exclusive content from Bronson Dant. Next, we are going to go to another good friend of mine, Ben Azadi. Ben is such a wonderful human being, and he's such a wonderful person in the low-carbohydrate and ketogenic space. If you've been around here and trying to learn about keto, he is such a great person to learn from and surely somebody that you would have come across. He has a real talent for taking things that can be really complicated and breaking them down in a way that is really simple to understand. He does a great job with that on his Keto Camp podcast, which I highly recommend. I also highly recommend his book, Keto Flex, where, again, he does a great job breaking down the science of ketosis and ketogenesis and helping us understand how to pull off this diet really well, which, as he points out here, is not a fad. Just because this might be something that's more new to you doesn't mean it's new to human beings. And he does such a great job breaking that down here. For somebody who is thinking about keto, maybe they've heard what it is and they think, okay, keto must be a diet. It must be like this fatty kind of diet that I've heard of. I saw it on a magazine at the grocery store. When I heard about it, I thought back to my nutrition book and said, like, okay, I remember something about keto acidosis and that was going to kill you. So this might be a bad thing. And then you have people that say, I am keto. And it's like, okay, well, I thought you were Mike, but I guess you're an identity, which is keto. So for the listener that might not understand, what is this keto thing?
I identify as keto. That's it. Yeah. You know, to your point, there's a lot to unpack there, right? There's a lot of, misinformation and confusion around keto, just in health in general. You know, the problem we used to have, Casey, and I know you would agree, and many would agree to this. The problem we used to have maybe 30, 40 years ago, there's not enough information for us to get the right information to apply it and change our lives in any kind of field, right? Now you fast forward to 2022, we got Dr. Google, YouTube University, all these podcasts, some good, some really bad. And now the problem is too much information. And when somebody has an information overload and they're confused, they don't make a decision. They're paralyzed, they're confused, and I've been there myself. And it's really not the information that's going to change anybody's life or anybody's lives. It's the application of the right information. If information alone was power and had the ability to change your life, then every librarian would be a multimillionaire. But it's not the information. It's the right information applied at the right time. So going back to your question, what exactly is keto? A lot of people say, oh, you're doing that keto thing. What a fad. It's a dietary fad. It's a weight loss gimmick. And yeah, you could do it. You might lose some weight, but you're going to get a heart attack or whatever kind of negative connotation people attach to it. The reality is this: keto is not a diet. Keto is a metabolic process. And guess what? There's nothing new about it. It might be new to you or nuanced, but it's been around for as long as humans have existed. How do I know that? Am I just making that up? No. If you think about our ancestors, they did not have food readily available to them 24/7. You think they had Uber Eats or DoorDash or Whole Foods or your refrigerator? No, they ate whenever food was available. And guess what? Sometimes that would be several hours, several days, or sometimes several weeks. So what happened? They had to have an alternate way of getting energy, an alternate way of fueling the brain. And that process is called ketogenesis, a metabolic process, the birth of ketones. So when you're in a fasted state, when our ancestors were in a fasted state, they needed to tap into their body fat, which is stored energy, and start using that as an energy source. And the liver then produces ketones. And the benefit of beta-hydroxybutyrate, which is one of the three ketones, the benefit of that one, it has the ability to cross the blood-brain barrier and give your brain a fuel source when glucose is dropping low because you're not eating food. So when you think about that, it's a natural process. But in this day and age, most people, not just Americans, but most people are experiencing a keto deficiency. They're never getting into a state of ketosis. They're never allowing their body to tap into their fat stores. They're never getting into this amazing process. And we'll talk a little bit more about why this is important for inflammation and weight loss. But it's really a keto deficiency. And there was a study, and I shared this at the Keto Salt Lake. I think some other speakers shared it as well. A 2018 study that came out from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And they looked at over 8,000 American adults. And they wanted to assess what are their blood pressure markers? What is their HDL, LDL, triglycerides, A1C, glucose, and other metrics like medication or no medication. And they determined that 88% of American adults are unhealthy, metabolically inflexible. That is insane. That was before COVID.
That was before COVID.
Before COVID. So you know what happened after COVID, that got worse. So now I would say 90% plus of American adults are metabolically unhealthy. They really need keto. They need this metabolic process. The real fad diet the gimmick diet that doesn't work is the standard American diet. That's been around, I don't know, 30 to 40 years, but keto has been around for as long as humans have existed. So that is what keto is. It's simply a metabolic process, and there's not one way to do keto. There are several. The way we teach it here at Keto Camp is, how do we reduce cellular inflammation with ketosis? So we view it from a cellular lens.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love the idea of looking at it as ketosis, and also the opposite of that being something like glucosis, where, you know, you're running the system in a completely different way, but nobody knows how we did it in the past. They're so used to this environment that we've been in, and you know, average is not normal. And we look around and say, well, everybody else is eating this way, so I must have to eat this way as well. And you don't even understand that there's this whole other way of doing things that, you're right, is not a fad at all. It's the way we would have had to live to be able to survive to get to this point.
That is right. And you're right about, just because it's average doesn't mean it's normal. And when you go to events and conferences, or if you're hanging out with your friends, it makes it more difficult to kind of be the outlier, because everybody's going to eat heavy carbs. You're going to be snacking every 2 to 3 hours. And you're like, I'm fasted. Or do you have more protein and fat? Like, you're going to be looked at as the weird person. I was just in Las Vegas last week at an amazing video and business and marketing conference. And they gave us, you know, breakfast and lunch and dinner. I got to tell you, most people are eating the high carbohydrate pastries and meals. And I'm there like, I'm just going to fast. I want to have more energy for the conference, right? And it's very uncommon to do that. And you're going to get some looks and some comments. So you have to really stand your ground. And I really believe your competence equals your confidence. And that's where, like, listening to podcasts come into play, or being around a community. So we need to change the way we look at health, because we know that if we just follow the mainstream media and the government guidelines when it comes to promoting nutrition, it doesn't work. It hasn't worked for so many years. I mean, if it worked, we wouldn't have the current statistics from the cancer.org website saying 1 in 3 women are diagnosed with cancer within their lifetime, and for men, 1 in 2. We wouldn't have 60% of American adults being diabetic or pre-diabetic. We wouldn't have the prediction that in 2032, 10 years from now, 1 in 2 children are going to be born on the autism spectrum. And the new latest prediction that by 2030, 1 in 2 American adults will be obese, not just overweight, but obese. So if the nutrition advice worked, we wouldn't have disease on the rise. That's why conversations like this and your show, Casey, so important. Grassroots effect. We impact lives. So that's why we want to listen to episodes like this, share it, and spread the message out to the world.
That's right. As much as I would love to believe that we could have, you know, a population-wide effect on people, at the end of the day, it really is about the individual and trying to reach the people who are sick of being sick the way that you were, and finding your podcast, which is absolutely amazing and such a great resource for people. So I love all of that content. And I love the way that you explain that. You had a few really funny lines in your speech at Keto Salt Lake, but my favorite was the one about the humans being smart enough. Can you repeat that one? That was good.
Yeah. And thanks, Casey. So, you know, I was talking about the disease stats that I just shared with you. And it's like, okay, if you look at, for example, just go to your grocery store and look at the average product and read the ingredients. I mean, there's so many things you don't understand, so many ingredients you can't even read, things you can't pronounce. And that's become the norm, all these frankenfoods. So the quote is, human beings are the only species smart enough to create their own food and dumb enough to actually eat it. And that is a fact. So beware of the frankenfood.
We are now just going to skip ahead a little bit further into our conversation of episode 290 of Boundless Body Radio, where we hosted Ben. He makes a really good point here about mitochondria, and I really don't want to miss this. So let's continue on with our conversation with Ben Izzati.
Get fat adapted. What does that mean? When we gave that stat about 88% of Americans being unhealthy, they are what's called sugar burners. When I was obese, I was a sugar burner. It's not a fun way to live. How do you know you're a sugar burner? Easy little test for you to do tomorrow. Skip a meal and see how you feel. If you skip a meal, let's say I'm going to skip lunch tomorrow and see how my metabolism, my body adapts to that. And you do it tomorrow and you feel like crap, you're irritable, you're hangry, you're not fun to be around, you can't focus, your energy drops, guess what? That's a big red flag. You're a sugar burner, and we got work to do. Hey, I've been there myself for 24 years. So we want to get fat adapted. What does that mean? That means we want to get into ketosis. We want to start burning fat instead of sugar. Not only will that benefit you in terms of your day-to-day, so you don't have to eat every 2 to 3 hours, but it's also very anti-inflammatory to use ketones as an energy source. Here's why. Ketones are, they do a lot of great things, but one of those things, and I was sharing this with Keto Salt Lake, ketones have the ability to communicate with your cells and your mitochondria. For those who are unfamiliar with the mitochondria, simply put, the mitochondria are these energy factories that produce energy, and this energy is called ATP. There are other factors that come into play with the mitochondria, but let's keep it with the energy production part here. So ketones actually communicate to the mitochondria to make more of themselves, mitogenesis. And when the mitochondria make more of themselves, you produce more energy. When you produce more energy, you burn more fat because it raises your metabolic rate, but you also feel better. Chronic fatigue, a lot of symptoms out there are linked to mitochondrial dysfunction. So if you have the ability to create more robust mitochondria, this mitochondrial fitness through ketosis, that is freaking amazing.
We are now going to go back to episode 248 of Boundless Body Radio, where I interviewed Nicole Laurent, and I asked her specifically, what is so special about ketones? And I love her answer. This is actually from the second half of the interview that we did there, and we're going to hear from her twice in this episode. She's really an expert in all things brain health and ketones. And as she makes the point, ketones do so many wonderful and magical things, but they also do a lot of really incredible things in the brain, and understanding that brain fog, especially, is not normal. That we get Alzheimer's and dementia early and early every single year is not normal. Ketones are a wonderful way to help us fight some of these diseases that are becoming more normalized, that are absolutely, again, just not normal. But I thought she did such a great job here explaining what ketones do in the body.
Yeah, so ketones, they're a little bit magical. So ketones are both a fuel and a molecule signaling body. And so to make ketones, you have to have your carbohydrates low enough. And when we're doing ketogenic diets for mental health, for specifically, like, we're not playing, they have to be really, really low, because we want those ketones to be high enough to fuel and repair the brain, right? And so anyways, I won't be mental illness specific, but yeah, you have to have a low enough amount of carbohydrates, which will then reduce your insulin. And once your insulin is nice and low, your body will start to make ketones. Now, it can make ketones from the dietary fat that you eat, so those butter coffees or those MCT oil coffees or whatever, or, you know, heavy cream, or, you know, all the tasty stuff. Or it can unlock your body fat and burn your body fat and create ketones from those. And the ketones have a lot of, like I said, signaling properties. They turn genes on and off. And that's just kind of the most simplest way to talk about what a ketone is.
Yeah, no, I love that. Thank you for that really clear explanation. And thank you for making the distinction between the two, because this might determine how you want to approach a ketogenic for yourself. If you're approaching it from the mental health side, you may want to consider adding copious amounts of fat or really ketogenic, you know, medium chain triglycerides in the diet to help drive those numbers up. Or maybe you're taking, you know, salts or esters or anything like that. But if you're trying to lose weight, you may approach it a little bit differently and say, okay, once I'm in a ketogenic state, maybe I'm going to eat a little bit less of the fat so I can burn my own fat that I've already stored previously by eating sandwiches for 40 years or whatever it is. So yeah. I'm really glad you made that distinction. I love that you talked about ketones being signaling molecules. It's not just a fuel source. They actually tell the body to do so many interesting things. Let's go to your area of expertise. What happens in the brain? Because we know, everybody knows, everybody says the brain cannot run on fat. It has to run on glucose. I hear that and I get so frustrated. You talk about what is going on in the brain when ketones are available.
Yeah. So yes, there are some itty bitty areas of your brain that require glucose to work. And there are parts of your body that will store glucose, like muscles and a couple of the organs. But you make all the glucose you need in your liver, It's a substrate that your body monitors. And I think, quite frankly, wants to monitor, right? We can only handle like a teaspoon of glucose in our blood at any one time. And your body works really, really hard to keep your blood glucose at that level. So it has a mechanism by which it makes glucose when glucose isn't around, and it keeps it constantly there. And there are just a few parts of your brains that absolutely must use glucose. But my goodness, you do not need to eat them. You don't need to eat glucose in order to get glucose to your brain.
That's right.
Okay. So that's the first piece, is to understand that carbohydrates are a non-essential macronutrient. You will accidentally get some in animal flesh and eggs. It'll just be a teeny tiny amount, you know, that sort of thing. There's a little bit in some high fiber vegetables, but really it's an accidental consumption. Your body does not need a lick of carbohydrates. I promise you. I know that's a super scary thing to say if you've never heard this before, but it is a non-essential macronutrient. Your liver, through gluconeogenesis, will make all the glucose that your brain needs. Okay. We do not want our brain awash in glucose. That does not make our brain happy. That increases inflammation exponentially all through the body, particularly the brain. And so we want to keep that glucose low. So there are inflammatory pathways, and pathways is kind of a fancy biochemistry term. And again, I am no fantastic biochemist. But the idea is that you have these pathways, and they get turned on when there is some kind of environmental stressor. That environmental stressor can be a whole grain sandwich. If you already have insulin resistance and your body cannot clear that blood glucose out of your bloodstream fast enough, that's a huge metabolic stressor. It can be environmental toxins. It can be, you know, almost getting hit by a car when you cross the street, right? Any type of really strong environmental stressor or toxin or whatever, assault, we'll say, any kind of environmental assault will cause an inflammatory pathway to be cascading, right? It'll turn that on. Well, and we don't want inflammation. There are few things, I mean, all these mental illnesses that I've been kind of deep diving in, my gosh, inflammation is a primary thing for all of them. If you've got leaky gut and your gut is unhealthy, that's also a huge inflammatory piece that will cause issues. But anyway, so ketones are signaling bodies. So they will literally turn genes on and off in that signaling pathway for inflammation. Ketones reduce the signals for chronic inflammation, which will then reduce neuroinflammation, which will then improve your mental illness that you are suffering from. And that is just one of the things that ketones do. The other thing that happens is that, as we've eaten our really high carbohydrate diet from childhood on, we develop a certain amount of something called insulin resistance. And that just means that our bodies have had way more than that one tablespoon of glucose to deal with all these years. And insulin resistance develops. And what that means is that insulin cannot push the energy or the glucose into the cells for energy anymore very well. And so it takes it a lot. Insulin has to go much, much higher in order to finally clear that glucose. And cells become resistant to it. It actually breaks the transporters, for lack of a better way to kind of explain it. And so that happens in people's brains. And that happens, you know, to some extent in people's ovaries with PCOS, right? But we're focused on the brain today. So people will start to have an energy crisis in the brain and not even know it. And so what that looks like is more brain fog, problems with memory. And this can happen, this insulin resistance in the brain can happen in your early 30s.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it can happen in your early 30s and you'd be like, oh, you know, I'm forgetting things more. It's not a big deal. But it is a big deal and you need to pay attention to it because what it's doing is it's setting the stage for future Alzheimer's and dementia. Alzheimer's is called the third diabetes. It's like diabetes of the brain. So that's the thing. So ketones are this amazing fuel for the brain. And even though there's parts of your brains that use glucose for fuel because they just have to fire faster than other, you know, other parts, your brain loves ketones and they don't even need a receptor. They don't need like a specialized receptor the way glucose does that can get all broken machinery, right? They just go right on in there and they're just instant fuel. Your mitochondria absolutely love them. Mitochondria are these little batteries in your cells, in your neurons, and they make energy. And you have got to have a lot of mitochondria and you've got to have healthy mitochondria. And so these ketones are not just fuel and they actually upregulate how many mitochondria you have and the health of your mitochondria. And when you increase your brain energy to that level, what that means is that your body can repair cells. So if you have had a high, you know, a hyperglycemic or a, you know, a high carbohydrate diet for many, many years or whatever, or you probably got leaky gut from all that, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff. So you've got, let's say you've got a really bad case of neuroinflammation and there's a lot of damage that happens with constant neuroinflammation and a lack of micronutrients that you need in order to repair. But you also need that energy component, right? Because that's hard work to repair cells and to keep them clean and to keep reactive oxidative species down and all that good stuff. Like that's a big job. And so ketones provide this really clean burning fuel in the brain and it upregulates that energy. So you start to get out of that deficit, that brain damage deficit that happens with constant long-term neuroinflammation and, you know, that oxidative stress.
Wow.
And so, yeah, like I could go on about ketones all day.
That's what I'm saying.
That's why I get so frustrated that we're like, oh, drugs, pharma. I'm sorry. Pharma does not do this, right? So there's some anti-inflammatory properties to like SSRIs, for example. They have a little bit of an anti-inflammatory effect. And quite frankly, I kind of feel like that's mostly the most benefit from them, but there's way better ways. Like the other thing that ketones do are they upregulate your endogenous in your body production of an antioxidant system of glutathione. And glutathione is one of, you know, right next to melatonin, which it actually helps with that too in a different way. But glutathione is like a fantastic, fantastic antioxidant. I am sorry. Throw away your vitamin C. Get rid of your vitamin E. You don't even need that if you don't need a lot of seed oils. And just upregulate your own body's natural antioxidant system. And it is an amazing healing force for your brain. And ketones upregulate that.
That's absolutely amazing. You're putting on a clinic right now. I love this. This is so important. It's so important for people to hear. This is why I really appreciate the work of, I want to say it was George Cahill, like back in the 60s, mm-hmm. where I don't even know if you could pull off these studies anymore, but my favorite study, I love looking at the graphs that show like a person in a fed state and they fast them basically, I want to say for like 40 days. And it shows the different stages where people's cells actually adapt. And the reliance on glucose when the person started was about 100%. And as it, you know, went on and the person went, or people went into deeper and deeper states of ketosis, the need for carbohydrate was a small part of the brain, like you mentioned, red blood mm-hmm. cells, which always need glucose, and parts of the kidney, which again, through gluconeogenesis, you can make that small amount of carbohydrate that you need. And you see so clearly on the graph, the brain is actually preferring the ketones. It likes it better. Like you explained, I think that's so important to understand.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so many great reasons to be in this state. And also, like, thinking about it from an evolutionary lens, I like to think of it the way Dave Champion explained it to me, where he said there's a state of ketosis and there's a state of glucosis. And if you think the way we would have evolved, there's no way we could have been evolving, relying on a fuel source that is really, you know, rare, unstable, seasonal, and it doesn't provide, you know, long-lasting energy. It's really quick. We would have always evolved in a ketogenic state. We see that in babies. That's why babies are so big when they're born.
Yeah.
Brain health.
No, absolutely.
They need to develop that brain outside of the womb, unlike any other animal.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So
the other thing ketones do that's interesting that a lot of people maybe don't think about and the link that it has with neuroinflammation is that it helps balance the immune system, right? So ketones have an effect on the immune system. In fact, there was a study there was a peer-reviewed article talking about those mechanisms and talking about early on how maybe it would be helpful for COVID, right? To put people who are suffering on a ketogenic diet kind of right away to try to use those immune modulator pieces that ketones provide. And that's really important because neuroinflammation is fed by inflammatory cytokines. So let's say, you know, like when you have the flu and you're like, oh, I'm sick. I'm going to sit down. I don't want to do anything, right? Like you just like, they call that sickness behavior. That's a sickness behavior. And what's happening, the reason why you just suddenly get floppy and want to watch TV and not move a muscle is because your immune system in your body has communicated with your immune system in your brain. And your brain's immune system then starts to send out these inflammatory cytokines. And that tells you to be floppy and to not have motivation to do anything and to just sit still. Like, we need to sit still so you can heal. Gosh, that sounds a lot like depression, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Easily overwhelmed. You don't want to get off the couch. Nothing sounds good, right? So ketogenic diets modulate the immune system. That's another way. So yes, they're signaling bodies. They're going right after those inflammatory pathways, but they're also modulating the immune system in such a way that it can balance and not overreact to things. And so when you get people who have autoimmune disorders, right? And their immune system is just constantly elevated and is constantly sending that inflammatory cytokine system going crazy with those microglial up there. Like these can be really, really helpful. So that's just another piece that some people don't know that I think is really helpful.
So like I said, we are going to hear more from Nicole later on in this episode, but for now we are going to shift over and hear a clip from Dave Champion. He is somebody that we've interviewed in episode 121 of Balanced Body Radio. Highly recommend you go check that out. And if you have listened to some of these other premium episodes, you've already heard his name in the macronutrient series that we did. I just think he does such a great job here identifying ketosis as a normal, natural human state and gives a name to the opposition of ketosis, which he calls glucosis, which I absolutely love giving that terminology a name so that we can identify it and talk about it. So go ahead and enjoy this episode. You're also going to hear about our good friend, Dr. Ansel Keys, who you heard all about in the fat episode of the macronutrient series.
And of course, since then, I've traveled 1,000 miles as far as understanding the physiology of glucosis versus ketosis.
So where did you first come across that term? I want to go into some of the terms you use in the book, and that's a really interesting place to start. Glucosis. It as soon as I saw it in the book, I'm like, wait a second, I've never come across this term. I have no idea what this means. You define it quite simply, and it makes a lot of sense.
When I sat down to write Body Science, one of the problems I saw with how the, we'll just call it the medical establishment has done business over the last, say, 150 years, is there, we all know what, when the 100 trillion cells of your body use primarily fatty acids and to a lesser extent ketone bodies as their energy source. And once you've been in ketosis for some period of time, your body has virtually no, your cells have virtually no use for glucose. So there's this other hemisphere. Ketosis is one hemisphere in which your body can operate. And there's the other hemisphere. And of course, we know there's only two hemispheres. So the alternate hemisphere, the one that 99%+ of the world lives in, is where their 100 trillion cells use glucose for energy. And they're being forced to use glucose for energy, which is one of the big problems with the public understanding, because anything they read by the medical establishment or by the nutritional research establishment says glucose is the natural, right, and proper fuel source for your 100 trillion cells. Right. And that's utter and complete bunk. But the problem I found as I started to write the book was, wait a second, back in the 1920s, the term ketosis was coined. So what is the name for the other hemisphere? I mean, we have the northern and southern hemisphere as far as the globe is concerned, right? Imagine if you had the northern hemisphere and nothing. How would you refer to the other half? Right. And that's exactly the dynamic that the medical community had created 150 years with what I had to finally come up with a name, glucosis, because we're burning glucose, right, in that mode. It was like, it was ketosis and then this other thing. And so it was like, so it's ketosis and the method that shall not be named. You know, like, what? This is nuts. How do you communicate? How do you talk if you don't have words that describe a physiological condition? So I came up with one.
Wow. I like it. I really love it. It's really interesting and puts it into perspective. On the one hand, you're burning fat and ketones. You are in ketosis. On the other hand, you're burning glucose. You are in glucosis. I think that's very clear and interesting that you had to go and name something that was just not even named. That's so crazy. Can you define for us the difference between cholesterol, lipids, and what a lipoprotein is? Because this is another big star of the show.
Okay, so lipoproteins is a gigantic category of elements within the human body that do all sorts of wonderful things. LDL is just one particular flavor or version of lipoproteins. Typically, of course, we all hear that LDL is the bad cholesterol and HDL is the good cholesterol.
Right.
And I want to be very clear that those descriptors are bunk and absolute utter nonsense. There is nothing bad about LDL cholesterol, and there is nothing inherently good about HDL cholesterol. LDL cholesterol has a proper physiological function, and HDL has a proper physiological function. When we drill down, we get into other subsets of those lipoproteins, which are things like Lp(a), which is a pretty hot topic right now in the ketosis world. You've talked to Dave Feldman and you've talked to Siobhan, so you're familiar with their work, and they do a lot of stuff with Lp(a). I think the most important thing for people to take away from hearing you and I talk today is, aside from the macro picture of ketosis versus glucosis, the most important thing is we need to get over this societal false narrative that LDL is bad and HDL is good. The reason, is this an appropriate point to get into why it is thought that LDL cholesterol is bad?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. So we have to go back all the way to the 1950s and Ansel Keys and his bogus research that was paid for by the sugar industry, in which he came out and instead of attributing the rampant increase in heart disease across the United States to what really came from, which was carb intake generically and sugar intake specifically, or I should say not specifically, but to a lesser extent. So we had this whole carb dynamic that the world had never known before, and that was fueling the heart disease epidemic, or what was viewed as an epidemic back in the 1950s. And so he took sugar money, and then he said, okay, so I took their money. It can't be sugar. So I have to find something else. And his research was totally bogus. One of the most outrageous stories came from one of his research assistants when he was doing research across Europe. And he would give people in these communities written questionnaires, and he would ask them to fill them out. And if the results that he got back on the questionnaires from the community did not confirm his hypothesis that he wanted to confirm because the sugar industry was paying him, he simply threw them in the trash and told his research assistants they obviously lied. No evidence that they lied, but since it was antithetical to what he wanted to say in the end, he threw them in the trash. So literally threw them in the trash. So he ended up with confirmation bias. If you want this hypothesis to be true and you throw away all the evidence that it's false, then the only evidence left is that it's true. So he did this seven countries report, which I talk about in Body Science. And that was spread far and wide across the United States. And suddenly, and Ansel Keys had a powerful personality, and he was a huge intellect. He was corrupt as hell, but he powerful personality, well-liked, well-received, came off very professional. And so he started to gain traction. Now, interestingly, he went to the American Heart Association, and he said, I want you to adopt the conclusions from the Seven Nations report. And the American Heart Association looked at it. They were like, nah, not really. Can't go there. This we don't see this as credible. So Keyes, being part politician, not holding public office, but he was very, he knew how to wrangle things politically. He actually got a seat on the board of the American Heart Association, then slowly brought his Confederates in. And when they had enough votes, they then had the American Heart Association vote to adopt his principles, right? Wow. Which were completely bogus. And starting in 1980, the United States government then adopted them. And of course, you know, whenever the government speaks, everybody says, well, that must be gospel. Right. So once the United States government adopted what had originated as Keyes's bogus conclusions, it was all over but the shouting. Mm-hmm. Americans started dropping red meat. They started dropping saturated fat intake. They started increasing all sorts of other things. But I think more importantly, the big damage here is the emphasis was taken completely away from carbs generally and more pointedly sugar. Mm. Which is exactly what Keyes was paid to do. And I have to give him credit. He did a fantastic job of misleading an entire country. And in fact, to a lesser extent, the world.
Wow. Yeah, it's so crazy. I mean, if this would have happened in any other industry, if somebody would have been developing brakes for a truck or something, and the brakes were shown to be faulty in their testing, and an employee just threw some of the records away, like, there would be a riot on the street. Like, it seems no other industry that this could be allowed to happen. It's so bananas. It's almost unbelievable. It's crazy.
Yes, and wow. Of course, as you know from having read Body Science, in chapter 13, I talk about the economic consequences. And it is those economic consequences, which involve trillion-dollar industries, which is why, despite you and I knowing all of this information and you and I living it out, most Americans, I'm going to guess more than 95% of Americans don't know anything that we're talking about today.
That's right.
The reason is the establishment, which to a great extent is the government and to a lesser extent, a number of universities and research institutions, the establishment has a complete funding blackout on ketosis. And that complete funding blackout confirms they already know what the results would be, because we spend literally trillions of dollars on medical and nutritional research, except on this one area where there is zero research.
We are going to go now to a clip from Dr. David Harper. This is another friend of mine from the low carbohydrate space. He is the author of the book BioDiet, which I highly recommend. It was very influential in my understanding and learning of low carbohydrate and ketogenic diets. This is a very complete explanation of the state of ketogenesis and ketosis. He does such a great job. He is a researcher, and I just want to have you pay attention a little bit to what he's talking about as far as the studies go. And we're just going to reemphasize something that David Champion said. Dave Champion. excuse me, said that there is a blackout in funding. It is very, very, very difficult to get funding into ketogenic diets because when people start ketogenic diets, they get better. One of the biggest risks of a keto diet is that you have to get off of medications. So the medical system and the pharmaceutical system definitely does not want people to find out about low carbohydrate and keto diets because people get better. So I want you to really think about that as you're thinking about this clip. I do want to say also, he does mention smoking here, and I think this is just an interesting aside. I am really listening to the book called A Case Against Sugar by Gary Taubes, who talks about this in his book. Cigarettes themselves were only made because they were able to soak tobacco in sugar, which changed the tobacco from being more alkaline to more acidic, meaning you could inhale all the smoke and carcinogens and nicotine deeper into your lungs, where before a cigarette, like a cigar or a pipe, you were not able to inhale all of that deeper into your lungs. So I think that is a really crazy and interesting side note about the whole smoking thing and its relation to sugar in particular. But let's go ahead and listen to Dr. David Harper and this clip talking about ketosis.
It was funny, though, the way it all started, if you want to know the beginning of the story. I actually had a radio show about critical reasoning, critical thinking. It was called Think for Yourself, co-hosted with a friend of mine. And it was on sort of local community access radio, like I'm sure you have in Salt Lake. And we had a guest on who had been studying indigenous traditional diets, which are basically ketogenic. I mean, there wasn't a lot of pizza and, you know, bread up there in the north, you know, and the Inuit and so on with Inuit peoples. So we were on and we were sort of talking about what's the cause and best treatment for weight management, right? What's the cause of obesity? What's the best way to manage your weight? And I was going to take this sort of exercise side, being a kinesiology professor. And I should mention my background is more in physiology. I'm not a professional kinesiologist. I teach anatomy, physiology, pathology, and nutrition. And he was going to talk about the diet side of it. And this was 14, 15 years ago, maybe something like that, or a dozen years ago anyway. And we were just talking about, and I gave the usual, he said, well, what do you think causes obesity? I said, well, you know, it's very complicated. His name is Dr. Richard Mathias. I said, it's very complicated, Dr. Mathias. You know, it's a multifactorial condition that has psychosocial factors and metabolic factors and genetic factors. And he just sort of quietly listened to me. He said, no, it's not. It's your body's natural response to excess carbohydrate in the diet. And we're on radio, kind of like we are now. And I just did this. Like we call it dead air, right? Because in my brain, my little brain was going, oh my God, like, because you got to remember, I've been studying physiology for like 25 years at that time. And I thought, oh my God, could it possibly be that simple? And why didn't I ever think of that? And it turns out it pretty much is, which brings us to the philosophical principle of Occam's razor, which is when you're trying to investigate the reason for something, first look for the simplest explanation. And don't look for a more complicated one until you've discarded the simpler one. And here I was suddenly, I was pitching the more complicated reason. And he was telling me, no, no, it's much simpler. And I couldn't think of a reason why that wasn't correct. And I thought, oh my God, carbohydrate, insulin, right, promotes obesity. And giving people their diabetic, you know, a high carb diet just makes it worse. And what if we just took that out? So I kind of, you know, getting back to the book, I kind of developed this model for all chronic disease, which has three factors. I call it the axis of illness, which is kind of a play on, you know, George Bush one's axis of evil.
I love it.
And anyway, so the three things, and any physician or healthcare worker will tell you, that, you know, the three factors, if we could address these three factors, we could prevent a lot of chronic disease and treat a lot of chronic disease. And that's obesity is one. We know that obesity is related to all kinds of it. It's one of the, after smoking, the leading lifestyle factor that associates with cancer, poor cancer outcomes, obviously diabetes, obviously heart disease, you know, these are all, and even Alzheimer's. So one is obesity. Another one is insulin resistance itself, which is the body's inability to metabolize insulin properly when it's been subjected to excessive insulin for a prolonged period of time, which is what happens on a high carb diet, because the carbs turn into sugar and the sugar needs to be taken out of your blood because it'll cause problems if it's left there. So you need the insulin to get it out. So I think people understand that role of insulin. There's other roles.
And the third part is inflammation. And we now, you know, we're now, I think people are realizing that cardiovascular disease doesn't have anything to do with cholesterol in your diet or how many eggs you ate last week or what your, you know, how much saturated fat you have. It's due to inflammation. And so those three things, inflammation, insulin resistance, and obesity are the three sort of cornerstones of what I call the axis of illness. And the thing is, they all make each other worse. So it doesn't even really matter which starts to manifest first. They'll make each other worse. And I think it just kind of goes around and around, kind of a vicious circle, until it spins off as one or more of these chronic diseases. So, you know, diabetes is kind of arbitrarily defined as a blood sugar level above this, you know, if from a fasting glucose test or a home IR or whatever, obviously involving insulin resistance as well as high blood sugar. So I think that those three factors contribute, are the root cause of chronic disease, and that a high carbohydrate diet in a chronic manner, which we've been eating for 30 or 40 years, makes all of those things worse. And you'll notice that people who are obese tend to have more cardiovascular disease and more diabetes. And that's I don't even think they're different diseases, Casey. I think it's just different manifestations of the same problem, which is at the mitochondrial level, which are the little energy converters in our cells. They're almost like little alien beings there in our cells. If those are healthy, we're healthy. If those are unhealthy, we're unhealthy. And I think if you look at the mitochondria, people with chronic disease, they're all unhealthy. The mitochondria are. And those diseases will often get so-called comorbidities. You get one, you get another, you get another. The healthcare, quote, in quotes, healthcare system will try and manage that. You know, so they'll, so your blood pressure is too high. Well, let's not address the root cause, which might be inflammation. Let's just give you an anti-blood pressure drug, right? It'll bring something that brings blood. Well, it's good for now, but it doesn't, unless you address the root cause, you're not really going to have a long-term benefit. So that's why we're now talking about reversal of diabetes, reversal of heart disease. Obviously, you can see reversal of obesity, like your client that you were talking about. You lost how many pounds?
Oh, in total, he's lost about 100. He started his journey 4 or 5 years ago at 300 pounds. He's just over 200 pounds now. But when we really started to focus on knocking carbohydrates out of the diet, he lost another 30 pretty quick and doesn't use the same medications that he was before.
Yeah, and that's what we're seeing. You know, 90 plus percent of people, this is from the Virta work, that are type 2 diabetic that adopt a well-formulated ketogenic diet. We can talk about what that means in a moment. 90% of people reduce their need for, of type 2 diabetics will reduce their need for medication. About 2/3 of people are just reversed completely. As long as they stay ketogenic, they don't need medication. And some of these people have been on medication for decades. And like, you know, sometimes 4 weeks later, they don't need to take any medication. Their body's been returned to its natural state and no longer disease state. And the good news about all this, those three factors, if you reduce any of them, they all start getting better too.
Yeah.
So if you can reduce that excess body fat, which we call obesity, and I don't like using BMI, as you probably know, but if you reduce your body fat, that's a good thing. If you can reduce your insulin resistance, and the way you do that is by monitoring your insulin levels, and you do that by, you know, reducing your carbohydrate consumption. If you can reduce your inflammation, you can do that by stop eating sugar, for darn sake. Sugar is poison. Don't eat that stuff. And get off of seed oils. You know, don't those vegetable seed oils, those things are highly inflammatory. They're full of omega-6 fatty acids. So if we just did that, notice I'm not saying like eat less, exercise more. I'm a kinesiologist. Exercise is super beneficial for all kinds of reasons. But the most important lifestyle factor in terms of chronic disease is at the end of your fork. You have to consider what you're putting in your mouth every day. And if you put really good tasting, high fat, high nutrient value foods in your mouth, like, I don't know, fish, beef, eggs, that's why there's an egg on the cover of my book, a little self-promotion there. And that is, if you think about an egg, you know, you open an egg and you see what's in it. There's the yolk and there's the white. And the white is just protein and the yolk is just fat and protein. And so somehow from that, you get a chicken with the same, more or less the same 200 tissue types that we have, you know, a few weeks later. So everything in, and there's no carbs in there, right? A little tiny bit, but there's no carbs in there. You don't need carbs. There's no essential carbohydrates. There are some beneficial and there's some argument about, you know, fiber, soluble and insoluble. I'm okay with fiber, but you don't need to eat any carbohydrates. So why our policymakers are recommending this high carb diet as being healthy, I have no idea. There is no evidence to support that. And in fact, the overall sort of anecdotal evidence, the last 30 or 40 years that we have been eating this high carb diet, we've seen an explosion of obesity. We've seen an explosion of diabetes, and heart disease and cancer are increasing, not decreasing, despite all the new interventions we have. And despite the fact that people quit smoking. So really, again, you know, you the most important decision you make every day is what nutrition you're going to get during that day. And if you adopt a well-formulated ketogenic diet for 7 out of 8 people, I think it will, and it's back of the envelope, you know, no meticulous statistics behind this, but I think you can reduce your risk of chronic disease by about 70%, 70.
Wow.
Yeah, for most people. And if you have a chronic disease, and obesity is recognized as a disease in the United States, so that, you know, so that the insurers can actually provide assistance there, financial assistance. But if you can treat, you know, obesity and reduce insulin resistance and reduce inflammation, there's no drugs that do all of those things. That's right. And even singly, there's no drugs that will do it as well as a ketogenic diet. So why wouldn't you start with the simplest solution that's also the safest solution with the caveat of those contraindications? Why not start there first and see how that goes before you start giving people drugs that have side effects that then need more drugs to, you know, correct the side effects and so on? I just think our healthcare system has it backwards. It's kind of like, rather than putting good gas in your car, let's just put like a bunch of, like, remember the old joke about putting sugar in somebody's gas tank? Let's put a bunch of sugar and crappy gas and, you know, kerosene and stuff in the car and see what happens. Well, it breaks down. Okay, let's fix that. But if you don't, if you keep putting junk in the car, it's not going to help.
That's right.
You need to fix the root cause.
Yeah. Dude, that is so well explained. I love that. Is it fair to take from what you said that you are going on record to say that the egg did come before the chicken? You just solved the ages long debate.
It did. And this is, you're talking to a biologist now, because of course, birds and mammals came after reptiles, and reptiles have eggs. So
there you go.
In fact, humans have eggs. They just don't have shells. So yes, the egg came before the chicken.
Perfect. Okay. Thank you. That's awesome. And it's good news also, that you said earlier, the eggs don't cause, you know, the heart disease that a lot of people talk about, because I think you and I both consume massive amounts of eggs and hopefully won't just keel over and die during this podcast interview with a heart attack. You've done such a great job explaining the axis of illness, which I absolutely love. It is so important to understand that yes, it will circle and cycle down negatively, but it can also cycle up positively. So I wonder,
yeah, and quickly,
and quickly. Yeah, that's the crazy thing.
You don't have to wait for 10 years. You can find out in about 4 weeks if it's working for you or not.
Yeah, that's right. I wonder if we could go into a little bit more, like explaining why it is that consuming so many carbohydrates is really so bad for us. When we hear things like the brain needs carbohydrates, or it's a quick accessible fuel source, it's good for, you know, my kids at their soccer game or whatever. Maybe we can talk about that, and maybe we can contrast that with why is a ketogenic diet so good for us?
Yeah. So there's a lot in the question that you asked, but it's a great question. So there are a lot of myths out there. You know, they're just myths that, like many memes, they just continue because we don't really discuss them. But the notion that the brain, for example, needs 150 grams of carbohydrate every day, that's because the brain cannot metabolize fats and cannot metabolize proteins. So it has to metabolize carbohydrates. There's an extra little layer of protection called the blood-brain barrier, and you need special transporters to get things through there. Well, we've known since Cahill studies in the 1960s that the brain can actually use another fuel other than glucose. The notion was that, and even when I learned physiology, you know, first year, it was like, oh yeah, the brain can only use glucose. So you have to make sure you get enough glucose in your diet. By the way, if I asked you just offhand, how much in terms of, like, you know, a volume, how much sugar, how much glucose is circulating in your blood right now?
Yeah, I know the answer to that, but I think the real answer would shock a lot of people. The answer would be about a teaspoon.
About a teaspoon, right?
Crazy. So,
yeah, and of course it's replaced as it gets used up. It's not very much, so it's not like your blood is really sugary. Otherwise, it would taste sweet. So it turns out that your brain not only can use ketones. Now, when you produce ketones, you produce it through fat metabolism. So there's an easy explanation of you know, how ketogenic diets help you lose fat is you're not burning carbohydrates because you're not, well, you are producing your own through something called gluconeogenesis, but the selected fuel, then you shift to burning fat for most of your non-basal metabolic purposes. And when you metabolize that fat, you produce ketones. And the only ketone is acetone, but it's all initially produced as acetoacetate, which is called a ketone body. Some of it gets converted to acetone, which is basically nail polish remover. And, you know, usually just breathe that out, which is how those sort of breath monitors for keto. I think there's Ketonics is a company that does that. And then the rest of it gets converted into something called beta hydroxybutyrate or BHB. That's a really beneficial fuel. It's almost like a super fuel. And I don't use that term lightly. It's a super fuel in the sense that your body prefers to use that. So your brain, if there is an available supply of beta hydroxybutyrate, if you're keto adapted, which by the way is the normal human state, you know, going back in our evolutionary path, your brain will selectively use that. Now there is a transporter that it needs to get into the nerve cells, the neurons. It's called an MCT transporter. It's not MCT oil, it's different MCT. But it goes down its concentration gradient. It doesn't have to be pumped in like glucose does. So it's actually easier for the ketone, the beta hydroxybutyrate, to get into the nerve cells and be burned there than it is for the glucose. And when it's burned or metabolized, it produces less inflammation, less inflammatory response. And of course, if you look at something like Alzheimer's, it's an inflammatory condition, as is MS and other things. So there's no surprise that that a ketogenic diet would have benefits for people with neurological problems. So one of the first uses in a clinical sense was over 100 years ago, or about 100 years ago, for epilepsy. And for some forms of refractory epilepsy, it's very, very, very beneficial. Check out the Charlie Foundation, for example, and their work promoting the use of ketogenic diets at over 200 hospitals throughout the world. I think that number is even a bit higher now.
Wow, amazing.
We've seen evidence that it's beneficial for Parkinson's disease. We've seen evidence that it's beneficial for mood disorders like bipolar disease. We've seen benefits for autism. And all of these are being studied, all these neurological conditions. So there's the brain now being provided with its preferred beneficial fuel that's less inflammatory. It's kind of like shifting from a gas-powered car in your brain to an electric car. Suddenly you're not polluting that environment up there. And the other cool thing, Casey, is in our studies, when we image the women to view their tumors, the heart is the most metabolically diverse organ, that it'll burn anything. You know, anything. It's kind of like a diesel engine because it just has to keep going no matter what. So you can throw sawdust in a diesel engine, it'll keep running. You know, the heart will do that too because it has to keep running. But when we see the women initially in our studies, and the imaging agent is a glucose, it's a radioactive glucose called fluorodeoxyglucose. So it has a little radioactive fluorine in there that allows us to image the glucose movement. And so we see it concentrated in the heart because the heart will use that glucose if it's available. But when these women are keto adapted, the heart disappears from the imaging. So what's that telling you? Well, it's, you know, the inference is kind of obvious, is that the heart is preferring to use a ketone because it's less inflammatory. And what's cardiovascular disease? An inflammatory disease. So the heart's smart. It knows that this is a better fuel. You know, I should be going electric instead of, you know, burning fuel. And the brain does the same thing. The two most important organs, you know, as far as keeping us alive and active, both prefer ketones. So that notion of 150 grams a day is just, it's nonsense. The brain needs as much fuel as it can, but it can get up to 80% of that from ketones, but that's only under severe starvation purposes. So where does it get the rest of the glucose if you're not in a starvation state? And that's through a natural process that all carnivores have, omnivores too, called gluconeogenesis, which literally means making new glucose. And that means you're making glucose for the blood. That teaspoon of glucose you need, that level of a teaspoon in 5 liters, think of it, 5 liters of blood, and there's a teaspoon of sugar in there. it can produce that regularly by taking the glycerol from fatty acids and mostly amino acids and other metabolites and turning those into glucose as needed, ad libitum, as we say in medicine. And so that's why you don't need to consume any carbohydrates, because you really only need them for the glucose, and the glucose can be produced naturally, which is what your cat and your dog does and most other carnivores. Totally natural process. Fiber, probably a story for another day, but it's there are beneficial fibers, but they're not metabolized into glucose. They're not broken down into glucose in the blood. So they shouldn't affect your blood sugar. In fact, some soluble fibers actually reduce the rate at which sugar crosses the digestive system. So you don't need it. There are no essential carbohydrates, right? And so the only reason we eat them, you did mention a couple performance states, and I can talk a little bit about that. That's more like Jeff Bullock's area. Parker Hyde, who's now at University of North Georgia, he's another guy to look at. He works with the US military there. By the way, there's a lot of keto people working with the military because they're high performance, high risk jobs, right? So we want war fighters to have the maximum mental alertness, the ability to resist hunger, the ability to perform without injury. If you're divers, Dom D'Agostino in University of South Florida is studying Navy SEALs, and if you're burning ketones instead of glucose, your brain can tolerate much lower oxygen levels, so you can stay underwater longer. All kinds of super cool stuff. And obviously, we focus on that particular subject group because it's a very high risk, especially those specialists like Navy SEALs, Rangers, fighter pilots, that sort of thing. Greater mental acuity. I don't know. That's pretty important when you're doing those sorts of operations, right? Ability to withstand periods without sleep. All those sorts of things are all benefiting. You have to be careful. Like, there's so many myths out there. I mean, there's been a couple of great sort of blogs written about all the myths about diets and ketogenic diets. And one of the main ones is that there are essential carbohydrates because your brain needs 150 grams of glucose every day. So you have to eat it. That's a myth. The other one is that ketogenic diets are dangerous. They're not. Every physician learns about a state called ketoacidosis, which is often a complication of severe diabetes, where it's an artifact of the metabolism that occurs when your body can't metabolize sugar at all in diabetes, and because it can't get it into the cells to metabolize. So you start metabolizing fats like crazy, and your ketone levels go so high that your blood becomes acidic, and that's life-threatening. That does not happen on a ketogenic diet.
That's right.
Full stop. I don't know why people worry about that. Your body will naturally regulate that at a much lower level, like a half to a tenth of that sort of danger zone. And you can look at any bloodborne factor in your body. And if it gets too high, it's going to create problems. If it gets too low, it's going to create problems. So ketones are just another one of those. But within that range, which we call nutritional ketosis, and I think that was coined by Dr. Stephen Finney, it's usually about 0.5 to 2 millimoles per microliter. That range of ketones, it almost trades off against the sugar. So if that's like one or two, then the blood sugar can be like three or four, which might be hypoglycemic to some people, but to those of us that are keto adapted, it's just fine because the brain and the heart are burning ketones instead of sugars.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's just so interesting when you put it in that context, how like you might pass, I don't know, some magazine at the supermarket that says keto and think, wow, check out this fad diet. This is going to come and go in a few years. The way you're explaining this, it makes so much sense from an evolutionary perspective that this is not a fad diet at all. This is our normal, natural state that we should be living in. And no wonder so many things optimize in so many different ways when you're eating this correct way. And you just common sense. And like you mentioned, Occam's razor, you just think, what's the most simple thing that's changed? You mentioned vegetable oils. You mentioned refined carbohydrates. If I look outside right now, it's a beautiful summer day here in Salt Lake City, tons of plants everywhere, diverse, all kinds of different plants. There's not food. There's not just random food growing on all of these diverse plants. They don't just give you their food all the time. It's a very selective and special special time of the year when you can find some fruit, maybe some vegetables. If it's not in a garden, I don't see any vegetables just growing randomly. We kind of have kind of made them in a certain way. And so you look at that context and then you go out and see all the soda shops and all the fast food joints and just the atrocities inside of a break room in somebody's office. And like, you have to make those connections.
Yeah. And that's the problem is our culture is built around cheap, packaged, processed carbs.
Well, we are going to stay with our theme of Canadian researchers, and we're going to go to one of our other favorite people, Dr. Ben Bickman, down at BYU, doing amazing work around insulin. He is the author of the book, Why We Get Sick, and is absolutely one of our favorite people to follow and learn from in this space. He was really kind of not looking to get into the low-carbohydrate space. He was just researching things like insulin and ketones and learned that there was a bunch of people like losing weight and feeling really good on low-carbohydrate and ketogenic diets. And so he started doing more presentations and getting his name out there a little bit more, and then he wrote his amazing book. So we definitely recommend checking him out, checking out our episode that we did with him all the way back in episode 30. And I just wanted to include this clip here because I thought this was a really great analogy that he had about the car and the stick shift. And I want to say that I will confirm this 100% with all the work that I did for over a decade on a metabolic cart. When I was measuring metabolism of people that were doing low carbohydrate and ketogenic diets, I can absolutely confirm, at least anecdotally, that most people had an accelerated metabolic rate, meaning a ketogenic diet will help you burn more calories doing nothing else but being you, which is so critically important, especially when most people look at the calories in, calories out formula in what I would consider a flawed way. They're trying to move more and eat less rather than looking at it in a way that why can't we get the body to burn more calories just on its own? And a ketogenic diet, it is an amazing way to be able to do that. And Ben Bickman explains why. I want to go back to something you mentioned. I want to go back in time. I think it was either 2017 or 2018. I had been working, measuring people's metabolisms in a lab at my gym for several years. I started to notice an interesting phenomenon where people who were eating a low carb, possibly ketogenic diet, they would come in for a test where we would measure their resting metabolic rate, the number of calories where they need just to stay alive. And I would see the results, and across the board, I would notice that people who were eating a low carbohydrate diet would have metabolisms that were hundreds of calories higher than what the average should have been for somebody their age, height, weight, and gender. And I would say to them, wow, like your metabolism is super high. So you need to eat this many calories at a minimum every single day, or your metabolism is going to slow down. And they would look at me and say, dude, I can't. Do you want me to eat Twinkies and cereal? Like, that's the only way I'm going to be able to get to that number of calories. And that was never really explained until you did an interview on High Intensity Health with Dr. Mike Mutzel. He also asked you to speculate on why that might be evolutionarily. And you had a similar answer where you said, look, I'm not an anthropologist, but I'm going to speculate and say that if I were a hunter-gatherer and I didn't get food one day, I would need to be more sharp, more alert, have better energy the next day so that I could be a better hunter that day. And that could be a possible mechanism. And I remember exactly where I was driving. I pulled right off the road and re-listened to that like three or four times until it sunk in. That's pretty remarkable. Can you explain some of that?
Yeah, well, geez, that's nice to hear that it had such an impact. Mind you, that was an answer I totally just pulled out of thin air. But it seems justified, which is why I said it. So I'm always quick to say, when I don't actually know the answer, I will say, well, let me speculate. And so that was definitely one of those times where it was, but I would say it's speculation with some information. You know, I'm not doing it totally without no familiarity of the topic. Yeah, so first of all, that's fascinating. I'm fascinated to hear what you had been seeing in practice, which is that a low-carb diet elicits a significant increase in energy expenditure or metabolic rate. In fact, a study was just published today, once again, finding the same thing in humans, that if someone has low insulin or adheres to a low-carb diet or a ketogenic diet, metabolic rate is accelerated to the potentially about 300 calories a day higher. That is a significant amount of energy. You know, I think you'd have to do the stair stepper for like an hour or something to get to about 300 calories.
No thanks.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Yeah, I don't want to do that. So I'd rather just eat a low carb diet. I do think one. So we have found in my own lab two interesting observations across cell, animal, and human studies that when insulin is up, it slows down metabolic rate in our fat cells. It's basically stimulating the fat cells to store more energy. Don't waste a thing, store it. And that's reflective of the theme of insulin that I mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, which is insulin tells cells what to do with energy. Insulin abhors wasting energy. It wants the body to store it. So it tells the fat cells, hey, it's time to go into miser mode, store energy. Now, it could be doing other things to other cells too. We just happen to look at the fat cells. In contrast, when ketones come to fat cells, they stimulate the fat cells to waste energy. They will, it creates this situation called mitochondrial uncoupling. And basically, the analogy that I use in describing that is if someone imagines driving a stick shift car, a standard transmission, where they got the three pedals. Now, of course, anyone who's under the age of 20 wouldn't have any idea what I'm talking about. But, you know, maybe they would because they saw their grandpa driving that archaic machine. So it would be like the person has the clutch in, they're pressing the clutch, but they're pressing the gas. And so the RPMs are revving up, but the speed isn't. They're not actually moving. They've uncoupled the movement of the engine from the movement of the car. In contrast, so they're wasting energy. They're literally wasting energy from the fuel. In contrast, insulin pushes it the other way. It makes the mitochondria more tightly coupled. So now the clutch is up. And now as they are depressing the accelerator, you are increasing the RPMs and you are increasing the movement of the car. You've coupled. You're not wasting energy anymore. You are getting action from it. You're moving. You're doing something with it. So back to the fat cell. When ketones are up, the fat cell is wasting energy. That might sound like a bad thing, but if you're talking about someone who's overweight, that's a perfect thing. Now they have this outlet for all that energy they're storing in their big fat cells. And insulin has come down, allowing the ketones to come up. And the combination of those, low insulin, high ketones, is very likely both playing a factor here. But now you've accelerated your metabolic rate in your fat cells by about two or three times. And now your fat cells are working for you to control their own size, to stimulate the use of what they've been storing. So this is part of this then could be what you saw and what people are seeing in the biomedical literature, namely an actual whole body increase in metabolic rate. But it all starts at the level of those little humble mitochondria, whether they are wasting energy or whether they are being miserly with their energy. And there's an interesting thing there, Ryan, though. People, or Casey, people, is your middle name Ryan? Is that why I said that?
Yeah, that's right.
You're accurate. Yeah, okay, sorry. Yeah, no, so Casey, fine. I'm sorry. So people, sometimes you'll hear a little radio ad and people will say, take this supplement or do this, whatever, this testosterone treatment or whatever, and it'll make your metabolism more efficient. Well, you don't want that, actually. If someone's trying to lose weight, they would rather their metabolism be inefficient because then it's wasting energy, which you want. Importantly, we did not see this happen at muscle cells. Muscle cells are not wasting energy. It's the fat cells that are doing it. So in a way, if someone has fat to lose, it's their greatest hope that their, you know, so-called metabolism would be less efficient. So when we hear a radio ad saying all that kind of nonsense, don't buy into it. They don't know what they're talking about.
Mm. I love that analogy. And I want to go back to it for a second because you've got the clutch down, you've got the gas down, you're not moving anywhere, but that engine is getting hot. That's really important. And that's related to brown fat. That's literally creating heat and warmth as a byproduct of wasting that energy.
Right. And so back to your example earlier of our earlier ancestors in a colder climate, it does to a degree, it defies reason to say, well, wait, if I am going hungry right now, why would I want to be wasting energy? I need to store it. And I do think in the long term, that would be a problem. Although in the long term, there would be other hormones that would start to fight that, like cortisol. You would start to have genuine stress hormones that would start to undo some of that wasting where cortisol is to a degree also having the body store energy as fat. But in the short term, I think an advantage certainly to our, you know, to any, it wouldn't be our ancestors, of course, living in Utah eons ago, you know, in this area, of course, Native Americans, but anyone, our ancestors living in a cold climate, say in Scandinavia or Northern Europe, there would have been an advantage because if they are in ketosis, they will be warmer in that colder climate when they are forced to rely on animal foods in the absence of available plant foods, they would be in ketosis basically every minute of the winter, and that will help them be warmer. So there could be that advantage if we're trying to see a reason why the body is doing what it's doing. Now, and I emphasize the word why, because that's an interesting departure from typical science. You know, for example, my role as a scientist is to answer the question, how? How are ketones, or what is happening? It's a how and a what. You know, what is happening to metabolic rate when someone's in ketosis, and how is it happening? I can answer those questions directly. But when we kind of ask a why question, well, why would the body be doing that? And like I just attempted to answer with my speculation, we can only speculate, because as I like to joke with my students, those are divine questions. By that, I mean, we ask the person who designed these human bodies, that's a God question, where we would say to God someday, why did you design the body this way? He would have an answer, undoubtedly. We can only humbly attempt to answer that with some speculation. Mm. So that's a why question, and I answered it with my humble speculation.
That's a really fair point, and I like that. So just kind of sum it up, like when the system is working, you eat the most nutrient-dense foods, which are fats and proteins. Sometimes in the year,
yep,
you find carbohydrates. When you do, they are temporary. Your insulin goes up. You're probably going to be storing fat. Then there's a period of time where it gets colder. There's no more or significantly less carbohydrate on the land. So now insulin levels fall because you're not eating them. So now you're burning the fat that you have already stored for that purpose to get you through winter. And in that state, you will actually be warmer and more energetic because of it. When the system is broken, we flood the food system with all kinds of carbohydrates that are available for you for your Saturday night Mandalorian watching. And
yep,
we eat them all day, every day, for a week, for a month, for a year, for 10 years, for 20 years, for 30 years. And we have all these diseases that we never used to have or had greatly reduced amount of them. And mm-hmm, they all come from the same issue.
Yeah. 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 Well said. In fact, there is a reflective of what you're saying. There's a guy on Twitter, which I actually don't visit as often as I used to, as Twitter is becoming increasingly a cesspool. But I loved his sentiment, where his handle on Twitter, and I wish I could remember his name, it was basically, I think it was, don't eat for winter. And it was this sentiment that you're expressing. Don't put your body into this position where it's thinking constantly that it needs to be storing energy to prepare for a period of fasting, basically, you know, a hard, cold winter. So don't eat for winter was his central message. And I think there's something very profound in the simplicity of that statement, where nowadays our modern diet allows us to mimic what perhaps our ancestors would have only experienced in brief moments in, say, the late summer and in fall, preparing for winter, like a bear, you know, starting to load up and for hibernation. You know, of course, we're not that kind of animal, but I still think there's something relevant in that sentiment, that we don't want to be putting our bodies into a position of where we're forcing it to store energy. We want it to use energy, or at least be at an equal level of using it as much as it's, you know, inclined to store it. And we do that truly by keeping insulin under control. Someone might think I bring up insulin too readily and too liberally, but when it does come to energy use, insulin controls those levers with profound precision and power. If insulin is up, the body stops burning fat tremendously and will literally reduce metabolic rate to store energy. When insulin is down, the body will shift to predominantly burning fat and will then be using more energy, using what it has stored. It's now breaking it down and burning it.
We are now going to be going to episode 100 of Boundless Body Radio to learn from Dr. Nick Norwitz, who has a crazy personal story about the ketogenic diet and his own health. But he's going to talk a little bit more about ketosis and how it can help people get into a better state of metabolism. And as he mentions, that 12% number, 12% of Americans are metabolically healthy. Keep in mind, again, that number was taken from 2016. More updated numbers in 2018 say that number is 7%. And I would argue that that is much lower now. Nick is going to mention also Eat Lancet. And it's interesting to point out, and I want to point out here, that there are organizations that make dietary recommendations for the entire planet. Eat Lancet is one of them, and they recommend a nearly vegan diet with tons of plants and fruits and vegetables and almost no meat. It's really scary, actually, the way they're recommending some of these things. You will be nutritionally deficient if you try to eat this diet. It is very, very low in essential nutrients that you can only get from proteins and fats. And it's really interesting if you start to investigate why are they pushing these diets on the world. You see all of the financial contributions. I would definitely recommend you go back and listen to the episode that we did with Jane Buxton, who wrote the book called The Great Plant-Based Con, where she goes into detail about Eat Lancet and all these other organizations that are recommending these diets that are absolutely nutritionally deficient. But let's go learn now from Dr. Nick Norwitz from episode 100 of Boundless Body Radio.
You can't imagine that what we're being told is wrong. When the data are looking you in the face, you know, you can't imagine that it doesn't make sense until you go back and read, you know, like the, you know, 483 page report behind the USDA dietary guidelines. And like, this is nonsense. Like, this is actually kind of bad data. And then look at the history of it. And then you realize we're actually being misled. And that's such a difficult thing to convince people of. Because like it's he said, she said, why would you believe me? I just got my PhD. I'm a 25-year-old. And you have this, like, you, these guidelines coming out from the government, or not necessarily the government, but like a panel of quote experts. No longer would I consider them experts, but it's a, he said, she said, you know, we both know more than the person listening, presumably. So why would you believe me? And that's a really difficult thing because, like, if I were in your position and you hadn't dealt with something, you know, some sort of severe health thing that pushed you in this direction, force you in this direction, I, you know, I wouldn't believe me either.
That's right.
So, you know, it's difficult, but all the science is more or less there. And then, well, in complete transparency, you know, the guidelines and a lot of these papers that are coming out now, like Eat Lancet for the Planet about plant-based diets, they're getting a lot of flack for being not scientifically rigorous or influenced by, you know, industry funding.
Oh, good.
We could talk like hours and hours about that as a singular topic. But anyway, I won't get on my soapbox about that. Instead, I'll transition to get my soapbox about keto. Although, first of all, let me just clarify. I am not trying to say at any point that everybody needs to go on a ketogenic diet or a low carbohydrate diet. That is not what I'm saying. I do not believe that. I do not believe there is one size fits all best diet, nor do I believe that carbohydrates are an evil macronutrient. As you know, some people in the keto sphere, as you can call it, like, it might come off as seeming. What I would say, though, is that there's a distinction between carbohydrates as an isolated macronutrient causing metabolic disease and removing from carbohydrates from the diet, improving metabolic disease. Mm. And that doesn't matter what carbohydrate source it is. So I'll just give you an example of a trial that was done a couple of years ago by Hyde et al., published in the Journal of Clinical Investigations. And what they showed is that, you know, controlling calories, controlling protein, giving people overall healthy whole foods diets, if you shifted, you know, calories from carbs to calories from fat, metabolic health just improves. So they were looking at people with metabolic syndrome. And this was a randomized crossover trial. So 3-4 week blocks. And what they found is in just 4 weeks, a low carb diet, a low carb, high fat diet, reverse metabolic syndrome in 9 out of the 16 participants.
Wow.
And those same 16 participants were in another, you know, a low fat, high carb group, same calories, same protein. They're eating their 5 a day fruits and vegetables. It's actually a very healthy diet on the surface. And only one, rather than 9 out of 16, only 1 out of 16 has improvement in metabolic syndrome. And other things that you wouldn't expect. And we can explain the biology behind it, or I can if you want, but things like, okay, so the high fat group, they were eating much more fat. They were eating 2.5 times as much saturated fat. So 100 grams in that group, 100 grams of saturated fat per day. So you'd expect, oh, compare them to the low fat group. Their saturated fat in their blood and their fat in their blood must be higher.
They're dead.
Guess what?
They're dead.
It's lower. They're eating 2.5 times more saturated fat and the saturated fat in their blood is lower.
Wow.
That's actually because most of the saturated fat in your blood comes from carbohydrates.
Yep, that's right.
And being, you know, metabolically unhealthy, you know, depending on how long we go, I'm happy to talk a little bit about the science there. But there's studies showing that, you know,
removing carbohydrates can be healthy. And the reason that's relevant is because, okay, if you're already metabolically healthy, maybe you can handle some carbs. Maybe you're insulin sensitive. But analyses show that only about 12%, this was in 2016, or at least according to the 2016 NHANES data, 12% of people were absent of markers of metabolic syndrome, which means 12% of people are metabolically healthy and insulin sensitive. So maybe 12% of people can get away with eating carbs. What if you're not in the 12%? What if you're the majority of people, the 88%? And wouldn't it make sense to address, you know, dietary guidelines to the 88, 90% of people rather than the 12%? So maybe the guidelines are just fine for the 12%. Actually, I was in the 12%. It didn't work for me. So I still don't think they necessarily work, even if you're in the 12%. But let's just, I do want to frame that what I'm talking about is mostly those 88%, because most people are metabolically unhealthy. And you don't always know. You can be very thin, totally normal weight and have metabolic syndrome or have diabetes. In fact, 15% of people, I think, with type 2 diabetes, so tens of millions in the United States are on normal weight. Mm. Weight is not a very good proxy for metabolic health. You need other things. So that is, you know, where I'm coming from. Now, as for keto, a ketogenic diet is, basically speaking, one that really reduces carbohydrates. So generally less than 25 grams of net carbs per day. So total carbs minus fiber, although there are caveats to that. You can eat more. Some people can eat more. Some people need less. And it's moderate in protein. So look, I eat 1 gram per pound of protein, per pound of body weight protein per day. And then, you know, it's really rich in fat, like lots and lots of fat. I eat probably 350 grams of fat a day. Mm. That's probably more than most people. I have a pretty high energy needs, but a lot of fat. So that's generally what it looks like. And it's more on the extreme end of just what I would call therapeutic carbohydrate reduction, TCR. So depending on what ails you, you know, keto is not an all-in or all-out thing. Like, yes, you have to be at a certain level to get into the metabolic state of ketosis, which I'll explain in a minute. But if you're just trying to, you know, lower your blood glucose levels and improve your insulin sensitivity, say you have diabetes, then it's not like you have to eat fewer than 25 grams of carbs per day or it doesn't work. It's just about, you know, it's all on a spectrum. So for a lot of metabolic diseases, it's just about, I would say, first principle, getting rid of sugars and refined grains in your diet, which are effectively the same thing because refined grains are sugar.
That's right.
You know, if you do that and you're eating a whole foods diet that's also low in like sugary tropical fruits, which are also problematic for a lot of people, then, you know, you're going to have a lot of improvement in your health. That alone will do a lot. Now, keto does have certain metabolic advantages, being in the state of ketosis, which is where your body, your liver mostly, turns fat into these ketone molecules. So ketone molecules, there are really three forms. There's beta hydroxybutyrate, acetoacetate, and acetone. Acetone is like a waste product. You blow it out in your breath. That's that fruity smell if you have keto breath. Yep. Acetoacetate and beta hydroxybutyrate are both more active forms. Beta hydroxybutyrate is probably the primary one. It's the one mostly found in your blood. And so what these molecules are, they have two natures. I think this is really important that they have two natures, not just one. The one nature that gets talked about a lot is, oh, they're great fuel. They're like brain fuel. And they are. Like ketones are probably the best brain fuel. A brain running on ketones is generally a pretty healthy brain, which is why ketogenic diets help improve the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. There was actually just a trial came out this year, Phillips et al., showing that as compared to a low-fat diet, a ketogenic diet massively outperformed the ketogenic diet outperformed the low-fat diet and improving Alzheimer's disease quality of life and daily functioning significantly. Mm. That was a New Zealand study. Other conditions like Parkinson's disease, you know, there's so many, epilepsy, of course, mental illnesses as well.
Yep.
And I can give you papers to link, you know, in the notes, a plethora of them. Like I said, there's a lot of data on this, but, you know, ketones are great brain fuel. That's their first nature. Their second nature, though, is they're phenomenal signaling molecules. They're like hormones. They have their own receptors on cell surfaces, G-protein coupled receptors. They go inside cells to change how the way genes are expressed. And they modify proteins. There was a paper that just came out that showed that molecule, beta-hydroxybutyrate, this is in Science Advances, I think, binds to and modifies, I think it was 1,397 unique proteins.
Wow.
Including DNA histones at 36 different sites to change the way your genes are expressed, the way your DNA is expressed. And there are so many advantages in so many different tissues, from the pancreas to the heart to, the brain, of course. That's my area of expertise. And so I just want to point that out that, ketones as a molecules, they're great fuel and they're great signaling molecules, really. And the last thing I'll say before I do want to just pause for a second so you can ask questions. I feel like I've just been talking, but to dispel this myth that ketogenic diets are a fad, like I said at the beginning, this is what I thought, because they're not. In fact, I would say they're more appropriately a rebranding of the oldest human diet. So low fat is a fad. It's new. People jumped onto it. It doesn't really work. Yep. It doesn't really make sense with our biology. But if you think back, it's like, okay, ask the question. So what is a ketogenic diet? A ketogenic diet is one in which your body makes ketones. Okay. Humans are the best animals at making ketones. Why would that be? What else are we, what else distinguishes us? Well, our big brains. And it turns out that during evolution, we would need to be able to do ketogenesis, making ketones, because if we didn't, the only other option to feed our hungry brains would be to basically degrade our lean muscle tissue, our skeletal muscle, our heart, et cetera, to make some sugar for the brain. And then we would have starved very, very quickly.
Yep.
When we didn't have carbohydrates around, which a lot of the time we didn't, especially like today. This is a controversial opinion. But things like I consider like a banana, I consider that a processed food because people are like, oh, it's natural. But we didn't grow up, evolve with these foods around frequently. And when they were around, that banana had not been artificially selected. It looked like
right.
the size of your fist. It had big seeds and very little sugar.
Yep.
Plus, you worked really hard to get it and you only got it seasonally.
Seasonally. Yes, that's so important. Thank you. Thank you.
So, we can get into cyclic keto later, but anyway, we went into ketosis all the time as a species. And no, we also ate carbs. That's totally true. But we were going into and out of ketosis and remaining, I guess I would say, in that 12%, which most people are not now. So effectively, in the modern era, we're starving our body from being able to delve into the fat-based operating system, which, is our metabolic operating system. And most of us can't go there anymore. Adapting to a ketogenic diet, actually, more than just generating ketones, it resets metabolism in a way that is in agreement with how our species evolved, how it was supposed to evolve, and how we're supposed to run. Not on free Krispy Kremes after you get your vaccine, which just ticks me off that people are doing
so
that.
Dumb. But, so dumb.
It doesn't make a lot of sense. But, versus things like fat and including fatty animal products. And you don't have to do keto that way. We can talk about different ways to do keto. You mentioned I had a book coming out on a Mediterranean ketogenic diet. People can do that. I've helped people on vegetarian and even vegan ketogenic diets. There's lots of different ways to get your body into that proper metabolic operating system. And when you do that, you'll be astonished at the kind of conditions that improve. And the best part for me is it's always like things improve in people that they didn't expect. Like so many times people come and they're like, Nick, can you help me lose weight? Because that's what I hear, keto's for.
Yep.
And I notice other things like, okay, they're pre-diabetic. Okay. They have some, sometimes they have mental health issues, sometimes serious. And what inevitably happens is they lose the weight. But concurrent with that, they say like my OCD is gone. Like, this is so weird. My anxiety is gone. And my glucose levels are better. My doctor's like, what are you doing? Like, I have never seen someone, get off insulin and now you just don't eat it. it's pretty cool to see.
It is.
Because again, it's affecting that trunk of the tree. And so what comes with that is healthier branches all around, even things you weren't expecting.
At this point in the conversation, you have heard the word cancer be thrown around a few times, and there are people in the world who are researching whether or not ketogenic diets can be helpful in the diagnosis of cancer and also as an adjunct with the treatments of cancer, notably like chemotherapy and radiation. And one of those researchers is Travis Christofferson, who we're going to hear from next. He does wonderful research in this world and has written several very interesting books about the medical system. He's really going to hammer home the point of ketosis being helpful for lots of different things, but especially in the treatment and prevention of cancer, which I find endlessly fascinating. So let's listen to Travis Christofferson. How did you become so interested in ketones to begin with?
Oh, man. That goes back to tripping over the truth when I was researching this sort of non-standard cancer theory, the metabolic theory of cancer. And the low-hanging fruit of therapeutics was obviously a switch away from glucose metabolism to ketone metabolism. So that was 2014. And I just started reading, you know, the literature, the publications on the ketogenic diet. And there was not nearly as much then as there is now. If you look at a Google trend search of ketones, it just exploded around that time. So people became very interested in it. But, you know, it showed such incredible therapeutic potential for just a wide, almost, inconceivable amount of maladies, from traumatic brain injury to Parkinson's, all neurodegeneration, and obviously cancer. So it was just a dive into those publications. And then realizing that, you know, it had this malign history of being the sort of pathological state. And then sort of around the 70s began viewed as a sort of elegant adaptation to starvation. And now it's really exploded into not only therapies, but just potentially for optimizing health and so forth. But yeah, just absolutely fascinating biochemistry. The scientific story behind it's fascinating because of the characters involved in the science were such compelling people.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's still an ongoing fascination. There's still, a lot of research to be done.
That's amazing. You are so good in all of your books at weaving together the science and the biology with those stories. You're like the best history teacher that I never had. Like, you're really good at exploring the context and the situations. And, you know, all the work of Otto Warburg is amazing, but under a certain context is even more rich and dynamic. And you do such a good job telling those stories. I really can appreciate that. For somebody who hears ketone and they think, oh yeah, I know what that is. I saw a magazine cover at the grocery store and I think I'm supposed to eat a bunch of butter and, you know, chug the butter in my coffee and maybe eat lots of bacon. Can you explain like the difference between like what most people may think of when they hear keto versus what the actual molecule is, how it originates in the body and some of the things that it does?
So the way I think of a ketogenic diet is sort of the nutritional maintenance of the fasting state. And the way ketones were first discovered is when a person just doesn't eat for a period of time, their body really has no choice but to start mobilizing fat and generating ketones as a source of to replace glucose, because you burn through carbohydrates in about 24, 36 hours, and then there's none left in store. So your body's faced with this crisis. And when it mobilizes fat, it begins this sort of biochemical process of burning it called beta oxidation. To do that, it cleaves off two carbon chunks to acetyl-CoA. That enters the cell. And then there's a huge spillover effect of that acetyl-CoA. And so there's enzymes waiting to convert that to what we call ketone bodies in the liver. And then those are exported in the circulation to replace glucose, especially for the brain, which can burn up to 2/3 of ketones when you're in this fasted state. So it's really, it's a replacement for when you don't have food. The ketogenic diet just sort of is a hack to maintain that fasted state. So you just drop carbohydrates down to a very low level and you up your fat and then you stay in that, kind of the fasted state. Whether that's natural, you have to go back through evolutionary history and really be able to pin down what people ate to know if a ketogenic diet is a natural diet that we sort of evolved eating or not. But certainly we evolved to not eat for periods of time. So all that still has to be sorted out. Whether maintaining a ketogenic diet for a healthy person over a long period of time is a good idea or should you cycle? Those sorts of questions need to be worked out.
Sure. Yeah. But the idea that humans can go longer than a few days without glucose, it's such a foreign concept, or at least it was for a long time. You mentioned the studies and we talked about this last time. Are we still referring to some of those Cahill studies where he did the 40-day fasting and showed where the different fuel sources were coming from and how different parts of the body were utilizing them?
You know, Cahill was a pioneer. He was the one that looked at this first through the lens of a adaptation that was beneficial to humans, not as a pathological state. And he was, when he did the math on carbohydrate metabolism, nobody could figure out how a human could not eat for 30 days. So a normal weight person can go, you know, easily 30 days without eating as long as they have water. And the math didn't work out because you burn through blood glucose too fast. At that time, it was thought that the brain could only use glucose. And so he was the first one to prove, to show that the brain switched over to this sort of it had this hybrid capacity to switch over to ketone bodies. And that solved the dilemma of how can a person go so long without eating? The longest fast ever was a guy. He went, I think, a year and 11 days. You know, he had plenty of fuel to start with. I think he weighed 400 pounds when he started, but he was fine. You know, they gave him some electrolytes and supplements, but he was fine for over a year without food.
Wow, that's incredible. I can say just anecdotally, well, I had a client once that would do extended fast during the week. He would have his last meal on Sunday, and then he literally would just have coffee in the mornings and wouldn't eat again until Friday. And I trained him on Tuesdays and Fridays, and he would come into the gym hungry on Tuesday. He would not be hungry on Friday. And dude, I kid you not, he would PR deadlifts on Friday. He felt great. You wouldn't think that would be possible. It's incredible.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. My son, he's a sprint athlete, yeah. You know, deadlift, same thing. So he's a push athlete for the USA bobsled team. And these guys are, if you're going to go to the far end of the spectrum of athletes, they're the dragsters. You know, they are just designed to sprint for 15, 30 meters as fast as you can, carrying a load. And, you know, in a fasted state, there's plenty of blood glucose there to maintain. And, you know, if you're taking creatine and you have enough phosphate energy, you can explode like that. So it's not a detriment to, I don't think it's a detriment at all to those sort of sprint activities.
Yeah, that's awesome. I also know of somebody in England who just completed some 5 days of cycling where they were doing like at least 100K every single day. And they did the whole thing fasted. And I know they documented a lot of their health metrics and numbers. And just, you're right, like sprinting, you wouldn't even think you could be able to do that. Sprinting with no, you know, quote unquote fuel. I just think we so much underappreciate what our bodies can do with so little inputs. It can just kind of sort things out itself.
Yeah, we're incredibly adaptive. Yep. Yeah, that's a good and tweakable. It's always amazing to me, like even taking certain supplements or things like that, you can dramatically change just the physiology and biochemistry that's going on in the body. And it's got an amazing recovery capacity, bounce back from insults. You know, it's we don't give it enough credit. It's an incredible machine.
Yeah. I totally agree. One of the cool things from the Cahill studies that I, you know, really didn't appreciate at first was the gluconeogenesis that happens in the body. I think that most people would think like, okay, I don't have carbohydrate fuel, so I need it from somewhere. So now I'm going to ramp up my gluconeogenesis. My body is just going to start removing muscle tissue like gangbusters to turn it into sugar. But the thing I didn't appreciate was as your body is reducing its need for sugar, the need of gluconeogenesis reduces so low that it can get it from other sources besides muscle. You can absolutely maintain muscle mass in an extended fast just fine.
Oh, yeah. Ketones are, you know, they always say muscle sparing, which I think is sort of a funny thing to say because glucose is muscle sparing, right? Anything you can burn beyond protein is muscle sparing. But the way your body patchworks together the metabolism to replace blood glucose when you don't have carbs, there's all kinds of pathways. It's not just gluconeogenesis. For example, a bear that hibernates, right? They don't need as much glucose because their brains are not as big. Humans are special because we have this huge metabolic sink, our brains. It costs us 20% of our basal metabolism. So it's a big problem for us when we don't eat. But what bears can do is just by burning the fat they've stored, when it comes at triglycerides, you cleave off the glycerol molecule, 3-carbon, they can use that glycerol to make glucose. So they never even need to you know, use protein for gluconeogenesis to replace glucose. We do that. We do all sorts of alternative pathways to replace the blood glucose. So it's not necessarily just the, you know, the gluconeogenesis from protein that's feeding it.
Such a great point. That's fascinating. Yeah. We've already mentioned cancer, and we talked quite a bit about cancer last time, but just to reiterate, how beneficial are ketones in the cancer treatment world, and what have we learned even more recently about that?
It's still an ongoing thing, Casey. And, you know, what's frustrating is the clinical trials are so hard to do because there's no money to be made. You know, there's no drug, patentable drug. So you got to rely on foundations or when the NIH is feeling sort of philanthropic. But it's when you look at what happens. So cancer cell has an insatiable appetite for glucose. We know that. That's what a PET scan is. A PET scan is radiolabeled glucose, and you can visualize tumors that way. You inject somebody with radiolabeled glucose, and the tumor cells preferentially take it up and trap it in the cell. So the idea behind the ketogenic diet is you bring down blood glucose, you replace it with a ketone body, which has to be burned in the mitochondria. And we know that cancer cells have impaired mitochondrial function. Whether it's intentional by the cancer cell or it's damaged, that's still an ongoing debate. But we know that they don't like to burn ketones as much. So what you get is you get this rarely happens in pharmacology, this beautiful therapeutic differential where healthy cells have switched over to burning ketones, which causes them to go into this regenerative, reparative state. They become very robust to insult, right? And then the cancer cells are struggling because they're not getting enough energy to fuel all their growth, and especially to mop up free radicals. They're always on this very precarious edge of dying from oxidative stress. And that's what radiation and chemo is oxidative stress. So you set them up, you set up the cancer cells to die easier and healthy cells to go through insult more. So when you have somebody in that state and then you give them chemotherapy or radiation, you see a more dramatic effect. You see a more therapeutic effect, but you also see a huge reduction in side effects.
Thank you so very much for listening to this special episode taken from the Boundless Body Radio Premium Podcast. If you haven't already, please follow our show on Apple Podcasts and be sure to leave us a rating and review on that platform, as it is the best way to continue to get our message out to new people all over the world. And as we said in the introduction, feel free to book a 30-minute complimentary session with us on our website at myboundlessbody.com so we can discuss your health and fitness goals and help you come up with a plan. Thank you so very much, as always, for listening to Boundless Body Radio.